Testament again, you know the routine now, the 17:5:17 or the 5:12:5:5:12. We're just going to go through the books of the Bible, and I want to do it again with you. We got several who are new to this class, and so for their benefit, you can help teach them here. Let's say our books of the Bible is going all the way through our Old Testament. Genesis, Exodus, okay, y'all did that on 4-4 beat. That was really good. I like that. And so that's important for you to know that. Not just the names, but I could just, if I were to say right now, Job. Some of you, maybe new to the Bible, would say, I got a job. No, Job is what? If I was to say the word Job, what comes to your mind? Anybody? What comes to your mind? David, what comes to your mind when I say Job? A righteous man who went through some problems, but he remained righteous through it all. If I was to say Ecclesiastes, Adam, what would you say? Wisdom. God showing wisdom through what writer? Through Solomon. Okay. So I know some of you are out there now terrified that I'm going to call on you. So I won't do that. Well, if I say Jonah. Okay, Joel, if I say Jonah, I could say Joel if I say Joel, but Joel, if I say Jonah, what comes to your mind? A big fish, okay, got swallowed by a big fish, that's right, got spewed out. And that's important. Do you understand what I'm saying? That this is so important that when you come up with a name, you know the context of that book, and then you can see it, how it all comes together for our understanding of Scripture. So we're going through 2 Kings and so forth. And in that period, where are we on our 12-point reading of the divisions of history? Where would 2 Kings fall? Okay, the divided kingdom. Okay, that's where we're at right now. So let's make sure we are thinking about that. We're looking at 1 Samuel and 2 Samuel. Primarily, we're looking at what? The United Kingdom, isn't it? That's where Saul, David, and Solomon are found. And so you have the 120 years of the United Kingdom. But when we get then into 1 Kings, you're going to have kind of the early years of, Solomon is in there, 1 Kings 3 through 11. And so you'll have a little bit of the United Kingdom there, but then there's the division that takes place. How does the division take place? How does the division of Israel, when they were once united for over a century, and then all of a sudden there's a breakdown and they divided and they never get back together again? How did that happen? Vina? Okay, that's right. And so let that be a lesson to you young people. Listen to gray-headed people or no-haired people, okay? So in other words, there's wisdom to be found even when the young people are saying you old folks are just archaic, outdated, outmoded, and you don't know anything. Okay, it's amazing how much smarter my dad got the older that I got. He just kind of stayed with me. But in 1 Kings, we have that nation's success through those first chapters, but then the decline takes place. And that's what you were looking at last week. We looked at the idea of Solomon's empire and how it exploded by God giving him blessings in that regard. Those early years of his kingdom were the golden era, basically. The days of David and Solomon were the golden era of Israel. That's when you had kings that were walking with God and doing what God said. And then when they turned, when Solomon's heart was turned by who? By what? Who turned Solomon's heart? His wives. Again, how many did he have? Too many. Okay. He had 700 wives and 300 almost wives. Call them concubines. They were wives, but you think about gaining 1,000 women into your harem and taking on a harem. What was one of the things that Moses had commanded Israel to do when they came into this kingdom? That's right. Do not marry outside of Israel, and do not multiply to yourselves wives. And of course, when they started doing that, problems started coming. All right, so as we look then at 2 Kings, let's kind of go through this book real quickly, and then we'll try to hit some chapter by chapter highlights. The divided kingdom, Israel is to the north and Judah is to the south. And in fact, let me show you kind of the map here so that you know kind of what happened. Where is kind of the dividing line? When they divided, where is kind of the dividing line? What nation would be the dividing line? Judah, Jerusalem, and those so forth. And of course, everybody was coming to, at that time, was coming to Jerusalem primarily for what reason? For worship, because what was there? The temple that Solomon had built was there. And so people would be coming down to worship there. And so that's where you would come and offer the, particularly what would be the great feast that Israel would come to Jerusalem for? You remember them? The Passover? Okay. Feast of Unleavened Bread? Okay. The Pentecost? And so when they would come down for those days and they would have their would worship, everybody was coming. Of course, there was going to come a problem with the divided kingdom now, because if Judah was down here where Jerusalem was, then that was going to cause a problem. So when you studied last week, what happened? What did Jeroboam do to resolve that issue? He was in the northern tribes of Israel. So what did he do? He put golden calf in Dan and Bethel, and so in regions where it would easily be accessible to the people, that they could get there fairly quickly, and resolve that issue. You know, and when he put the golden calf up, sort of like Israel had done after they came to Mount Sinai. They said, in fact, when they fell to worship this golden calf, what did they say about that image? Who did they call it? They called it Jehovah. This is the God who brought us out of Egypt. They were just wanting to have a physical image of what in their minds would be something representation of God. They would know that that's not God. At least the Israel in the wilderness did. They knew that. That was not God. Because who built it? Aaron built it. And so they would know that's not God, but they wanted a representation of that. And so when Jeroboam would know that they're not really going to believe in the idol that itself is God, but he's going to set up these golden idols in Dan and Bethel and say, "This, you don't need to go to Jerusalem. You can worship Jehovah God going to those particular altars." That's just one step toward apostasy. And that's one of the lessons I wanted us to learn, that it eventually digressed to where they did look at those idols as gods, but that's not where the original, one small step for man, one giant leap for apostasy. That's what happened here. We got to be careful then. One of the great lessons we take out of 1 and 2 Kings is that apostasy starts real small. One little minor deviance from what it was. And then you get comfortable with that, and then you can take another step, and then you can take another step. And before long, then you've got kings like Manasseh that have just led you into the pell-mell idolatry. And so that's one of the lessons we learn here. Any other thoughts on that line? Any other thoughts you got on that? So then we see a little bit of that. Primarily then at the early days, you're looking in the first chapters at the stories of Elisha after he takes the mantle from Elijah. It's interesting when you study miracles. We're going to look a lot about the miracles of Elisha. You've already seen Elijah earlier, now Elisha this time. Think about when were the major periods of miracles performed in the whole Bible. Since we asked you a while ago, we're trying to get this big picture of the Bible. A lot of people think when biblical times, there was always miracles. Everybody, every generation would see miracles. That's not true. When were the rash of miracles found in the Bible? There's four of them. There's four periods of rash. It means lots of miracles taking place. Where was the first one that we would know of, where there was a lot of miracles? I'm not talking about the creation, by the way. Moses and Joshua. That period of time, there was a lot of miracles. You can go and see all those miracles that were worked with the plagues and so forth, and in the wilderness, there were lots of miracles worked there. And so in the period of Moses, there would be miracles. And then where would be the next period of rash of miracles, not just a solitary one here or there? Do what? In the Judges, there was some, yep. There was some miracles there. And now you have them here. Elijah and Elisha, in the period that they served as the prophets of Israel and the sons of the prophets, the school of the prophets that they had there, there was a lot of miracles that were worked during that period of time. And then during the course of the kings, when Israel was going into apostasy, there were not a lot of miracles. And that was hundreds of years. You don't really have a lot of miracles during those last periods. And then, of course, where's the next rash of miracles? Jesus and then the apostles. And then after that, where's the rash of miracles? Zero, nada. We haven't had miracles since we just recently studied 1 Corinthians 13. What do we know? Miracles ceased. There was no more need for miracles anymore because the purpose of miracles was to confirm the messenger was from God or the message of written particle was from God. And so once we had the perfect will of God revealed to us, there was no more need for confirmation. It had been stamped, sealed, and delivered, and we don't need that anymore. I don't need to see a miracle to believe in God. The evidence is already abundant. And so we need to see that. So this rash of miracles that we'll see with Elisha is here. Kind of go through some of the kings here. So you have Israel then finally is taken captive by who and when? I want this date to be kind of registered in your mind. When was Israel hauled off into captivity? All right, 722, 721 B.C. When was Judah hauled off into Babylonian captivity? 606, there's three periods. 606, 597, and the final one was 586, okay? And the reason I ask you to think about that is, when did they come out of captivity? Because Jeremiah and other prophets prophesied how many years they would be in captivity. How many years were they to be in captivity? 70 years. So you can do the math. You can either start with 606 and go down to 536 when Ezra came along, or you start it with 586 and go down to 516 where there was another removal from captivity. 70 years is how God, he prophesied, 70 years in captivity and then you will come out. Exactly to the year, God kept his word. So again, that gives you proof of that God is writing this story. So the divided kingdom, and then finally we have the Judah alone period with Hezekiah and so forth. Any questions along that line? Any thoughts you had as you read this, as you go through 2 Kings, anything that stands out to you that is just, you're just itching to tell the class? Nobody's itching? No scratching? Okay. Let's go chapter by chapter a little bit. Tell me, we'll see how far we go in our class today, and then whatever we don't, then Andy can pick up in our study next week. So let's kind of look, and I hope that you got a chance to read some of the books of 2 Kings, at least glance through. Maybe jog your memory on some of these stories because they're so fascinating to me. I sat down this week and was reading 2 Kings in preparation for the class and just got engrossed in the reading again. I've read this, I don't know how many times I've read those stories, but they're just so fascinating. Lots of action going on. A lot of things are happening, and you can see the fingerprint of God in all of it. That's what's so great as you read this story, that God would send a prophet, he would give a message, and either they would respond good or they would respond against him, and then God would have to do something about that. And so as we look at the story, there's the first one we come to in 2 Kings chapter 1 is the story of Ahaziah is judged and then he dies. And it starts with the story of Elijah. Ahaziah upset with the prophet, and so he sends some messengers. Benita? I thought when a husband looks at a wife and she's going, you might not get lunch. Elijah twice calls down fire to kill the king's captains of his 50 soldiers. What's that story about? The king sends a messenger to get him or to talk to him, and he does what? Do what? Yes. Oh, okay, I was jumping the gun. I'm sorry. Okay. I'll get lunch. Okay. A lot goes on between husband and wife that nobody else knows about. Elijah, so he does fall down and goes through the lattice. And then, of course, what's the story here that I'm asking about with this story? This is interesting, though, because Elisha, with all these miracles, one of the things you're going to see, this story come over into the New Testament, aren't you? This story is going to come over to the New Testament in what story? Anybody remember the sons of thunder? The sons of thunder, what does James and John say they do when they come through Samaria and they reject Jesus and his ministry? And James and John want to defend him for that, and so they said what? They're going to call down fire from heaven. Yeah, and so they would remember stories like this. Okay, well then we can do it too. Elijah then calls down fire from heaven, kills the captain and his 50 men. The next captain is sent by the king, kills them. The third captain shows up with his 50 men, and what happens? Please don't kill me like you did the other guys. Please, please, please. And so God sends his angel. His angel says, go with him. And so he does. And so Elijah goes with him and comes down and tells the king, yeah, you're going to die. And he dies. So that's quite the story. It's the purpose, I think, behind all of that is to simply say, God was working with Elijah, and you better be listening to the prophets of God. When my servants, the prophets, as God called them many, many times in the Old Testament, my servants, the prophets, these are my servants. When I send them, they are, in fact, the word prophet means what? What does the word prophet mean? Mouth. It's what the word means. And the Hebrew word for prophet is mouth. It's the mouth for God. They speak on behalf of God. And you can kill the messenger, which is the case of what the king was trying to do, but it's not going to resolve anything. They killed the prophets. Jesus said in Matthew chapter 5, in the Sermon on the Mount at the end of the Beatitudes, verses 11 and 12, blessed when you are persecuted for righteousness' sake, blessed are they when they revile you and persecute you and say all kinds of evil against you falsely for my sake. Rejoice and be exceedingly glad. For so they did what? Persecuted the prophets who were before you. And then Jesus would say all the way from Abel all the way to Zechariah, the prophet, you killed and stoned the prophets that were sent to you. And so when God sends prophets, the prophets were often persecuted and even killed, but the message was true. And you can kill the messenger, but you can't kill the message because God is behind the message. And that's one of the great lessons we learn here. Any other thoughts on that? Anything that'll jump out at you? Okay. Chapter 2, if you got your Bibles open, you're looking along, following along, Elijah and Elisha. What a magnificent story this is, these two great prophets. Isn't it neat and exciting to study these two guys? Because the first thing you think about when you think of Elijah, what story comes to mind or what image comes to mind? When you think of Elijah, remember your classes when you were kids and you would come out with your take homes, and what would you have if you had Elijah on your paper? What was the image you had of Elijah? What? The chariot of fire. Wouldn't you have that? Or he was hairy. Is that what you're saying? Yeah. And so the camel's hair, and you had the image like of John the Baptist, who was like the Elijah to come. And so you had this picture of a man who was just bold, and he was a tough guy. And so Elijah, he's out there, and he's coming into his last days now, as you studied last week about him. So Elisha comes along, and what is Elisha? Who is this guy? Who is Elisha? By the way, if you look at the stories of Elijah and Elisha, who worked more miracles, Elijah or Elisha? Elisha worked twice as many miracles in the scriptures that we have. If you count them, he worked over twice as many as Elijah did. In fact, if you stop and think about that, what was the prophecy given to Elisha? If you stay with me, you'll get twice. You know, I won't, what was it he asked his mentor? I want to double the portions of what you got. I want to be double the man you are. And they go, well, you've asked a hard thing. But if you stay with me and you see me go when the Lord sends for me, then you'll get your wish. And he did. And so we actually see him working twice as many miracles as Elijah did. That's kind of interesting. So we have Elisha is following him. Elijah then ascends into heaven in this chariot. If you don't believe in the afterlife, look and see stories like this in the scriptures. The afterlife is true, that there is, in the Old Testament, there's not a lot of examples of this, but there are a few. What is another example of a resurrection besides Elijah here? When Elisha dies and he's put in the tomb, and remember what happens, anybody remember this story? What happened to when Elisha had been buried, and then somebody else is just, all of a sudden there's a raid going on, and they throw this guy, this dead guy, into a pit. And in this pit, he hits the bones of Elisha. And what happens to him? He's resurrected. He comes back to life again. Here's a dead man, just because he touched the bones of Elisha, is resurrected. And so one of the stories we learn as we study things like this is there are examples in the Old Testament of resurrections. Even though you didn't have one, what was the story of Abraham with his son when he went to offer him as a sacrifice? What did he tell the servants when they went to the mountain to offer him? What did Abraham say? And in Hebrews 11, we'll reiterate that and corroborate that, knowing what really was going on in Abraham's mind. He said, we're going to go away, but we are coming back. And Hebrews 11 tells us he believed that God would raise him from the dead. And so, even though he probably had never seen a resurrection, there was no record of one anyway. But to look at and read stories like this about Elijah and Elisha and the afterlife, that there is an afterlife, and the Bible is replete with example after example of this, that we are going to live beyond the grave. Yes, sir. That's right. That's right. Perfect illustration of that. Thank you, sir. That's a great way of looking at that. If you said that only through this son I'm going to, because I said Ishmael, but you said I could. God says no, not Ishmael, Isaac, and so it had to be through Isaac. If I kill him, then God's got to raise him, and that's how you can begin to think of things like that. And so as you look at stories like Elijah, he's ascending wouldn't you want to just meet, wouldn't you love to have seen that? Wouldn't that be exciting to see God swooping down in a chariot and picking him up in a chariot of fire and just zooming up into heaven? Beam me up, Scotty. Boy, wouldn't that just be just unbelievable to see something like that? And I mean, that's better than the USS Enterprise, man, getting to be hauled straight up into heaven by the chariots of God. Pretty neat. And then Elisha gets to wear his mantle. He takes his mantle, and one of the ways you know that all of a sudden things are going to be amazing is he takes that mantle and kind of a robe, and he's got to get back across the river. And so what does he do? He does what I used to do with my brother with my towel. He pops it, and the water divides. He's able to walk across. People, the 50 prophets are watching that, and they say, wow, Elisha has the spirit of Elijah. And from that day forward, everybody understood that. It's pretty neat to see these stories. Any other ideas here? Okay. Chapter 3. Here's the Moabites and their rebellion against Jehoram. So remember the picture I showed you a while ago of the maps. There was the story, the Moabites. Who were these Moabites? And where were they? If you look on the map, I left that picture up there. The Moabites would have been on the on the eastern side, south of the Dead Sea, and the Moabites were in that region. And so they would rebel against Jehoram, who was not very far from them. Israel was very, Judah was, their kingdom was very close. And so they were constantly having battles all through the Old Testament. Moabites and the Israelites were constantly in battle. And so they would rebel. And this king of Moab says, I'm not going to pay the tribute to you. I'm tired of paying these 10,000 talents of tribute. I'm done with you. And so Jehoram says, okay, he's the son of Ahab. I'm going to go get Jehoshaphat, and we're going to come and destroy you. So Elisha prophesies, and it's interesting when they Jehoshaphat, of course, insists on having a prophet of God, and they come together. And in this case, he makes a really interesting prophecy. He says, even though there's this famine and there's this drought going on, there's no water, and in this valley, he says, you can look out of this valley, which is nothing but dust and sand, and he says, there's going to be a valley full of water. And I'm sure they were sitting there going, how's that going to happen? How are you going to have a valley in the middle of a desert, a valley full of water? But God caused an image to come up into the minds of the king, and they thought that what was taking place, that they were running to the spoil. And so they said, to the spoil, to the spoil. And so they rush out with their army to go get the spoil. And what happens? They see this river of blood, and they say, to the spoil, but then they go out to it, and all they're seeing is, instead of water, they're seeing blood, and then they rush out there. They think that they killed one another, and they get out there, and all of a sudden they're standing out in the middle of, now they're surrounded by the enemy, and they get slaughtered. And so God creates this miracle of a vision that they see, instead of water, they see blood. And interesting. I'm in trouble again. I just lost lunch again. Okay. All right. She's scared to look at me now. Okay. I probably do have all that wrong, and if that's true, then you can correct me later. Or you can correct me now if you want to. The Syria? Isn't that what I said? Okay. This is on tape. This is not good. All right. We'll come back to that. I'll go study that again. 2 Kings chapter 4. Look at all the miracles of Elisha. I read that story so many times, I'm starting to bring them together now. Elisha's miracles. Let's look at some of the ones that he's got here. Remember the prophet's wife that had been widowed, and now she's in debt. So there's the school of the prophets. We know that in Elijah and Elisha's day, there was a thing called the school of the prophets. And in there, one of the prophets, his wife died. And so he would have been a friend of Elijah and Elisha in this case. And so Elisha finds out that she can't pay her debt. Somebody's coming to close on the mortgage, as it were. And so she's in trouble. She comes to Elisha and she says, I can't pay the bill. My husband's dead. Can you help me? He says, well, what have you got? Well, I've got some oil here. He says, okay, what are we going to do with this oil? He said, go collect as many vessels as you possibly can. So she rushes out. Her son helps her. They get all these vessels in here. And then what happens? Yeah, the oil starts coming. They fill up all their vessels full of oil. And then they run out. And she says, there's no more. So the oil stops. And then what does Elisha tell her to do? Go sell it. Pay your bills off, and then live on the rest. You and the son can live then. And that's what happens. And so here's just one of, must have been interesting. We think of the miracles of Christ and how many thousands we don't know about. It just simply said he worked many miracles. He healed all that were sent to him. And in this case, Elisha probably would have worked hundreds of miracles that we don't even have a record of. This has seemed to be one event in the life of these prophets that God was sending among them to know that their word was from God, because they worked miracles to prove it. Elisha blesses he's the Shunammite woman. We know this story. What a wonderful story. Go back to 1 Kings and see about the Shunammite. And she comes here for the woman from Shunem, and she says, you know, this prophet's always coming through. Let's do something for him. She asks her husband, can I just make a little room for him and a little place for him and a bed and stools and so forth? And they do. And every time he would come through, he'd have a place to stay. But in this case now, what happens? They said, well, what should we do? Gehazi, what should we do with this woman? She's done so many good things for us. What should we do for her? He says, well, we don't have any kids. Oh, okay. Brings her in and says, this time next year, you're going to have a little boy. And she says, no, don't tease me like that. No, you are. And sure enough, she had a son. And then when that son starts getting a little bit older, and one day what happens is that little boy grows up. Remember the story? What happens? He starts having some massive headache. My head. And so then she does what then? Who does she go to? Yeah, so she runs to Elisha. And of course, he's very concerned. And when she gets there, she says about what's going on. He's telling the servant, look, just give me my staff and then go take care of this. She says, no, I won't leave you. And so you got to go with me. And so he does. He comes down. And of course, here's another example we need to see of a resurrection. Elisha raises the Shunammite woman's son. What does that teach you? In the New Testament, can you think of an example of a resurrection that Jesus worked? Remember at a funeral, and the widow, and this is now her son, and her husband's dead, now her son, who would be her recourse for survival, is now gone too. And what does Jesus do for the during this, when he's coming into the town, and they're leaving the town for the funeral, and they cross paths, and he stops the funeral procession, and raises this child from the dead and gives it back to his mother. We see examples like that. Here's one example in the Old Testament like that. And when Jesus works those miracles, and almost every one of those miracles, you can go back and see a kind of similar story in the Old Testament to show you how God works to make in our minds realize God can work miracles. God can say, I am the resurrection and the life. And convince us through those examples, both of Old and New Testaments, that we're going to be raised too. And to know that God cares about even a widow that nobody else would think much about. That they would look down maybe on her and say, well, your husband's dead, your son's dead, so you must have committed some sin to cause the grief like this. But that's not what we see here. God cares about us no matter what our situation is. Then the purifies the pot of stew. That's just kind of a weird one. The sons of the prophets getting together. They have a little party or they're eating. And then somebody puts some wrong herbs in there and it poisons. There's poison in the pot. And they run to the Elisha and they said, can't eat the stew. And so what does Elisha say? Well, get me this. And he takes some of that and throw this and then put some salt and pepper in. He didn't put salt and pepper in. But he puts some things in there. He says, now you can eat it. They go, really? He said, and they could eat it, and they were fine. So he works a miracle just by doing something like that. That one doesn't make a whole lot of sense to us, except the fact that God even cared about his prophets eating, too. Maybe if that's the story. But then he also feeds the 100 men with 20 loaves of bread. Now, what does that tell you about the New Testament? He takes 20 loaves of bread, and he feeds 100 men. Now, Jesus can trump that one. He can take 5,000 men besides women and children and feed them with just 5 loaves and 2 fish. And they can feed 4,000 just with a little bit. And so we have this story of Elisha and his miracles. Lots more. Naaman, that's what a wonderful story that is. Naaman the leper, a Syrian, by the way, who comes and he finds out through his servant that had been captured, who was an Israelite, that there was a prophet in Israel who could take away his leprosy. And he goes and he finds, as he comes out there, he gets healed. Long story short is, he's told to do what? Go dip 7 times in the Jordan River. And his reply is what? There's better rivers in my country. The Abana and the Pharpar are far better rivers, cleaner rivers, more healing rivers. The Jordan is a nasty little place. Why would I dip there? And she said, if he'd have bid you do something great, wouldn't you have done it? And the answer would have been, yeah. Well, then can you do the simple thing? So he goes to the Jordan. He dips 7 times. On the 7th dip, he is healed. And so then what a wonderful story. Of course, that's a beautiful illustration to us of what baptism represents. I think that story is put there for our edification and what baptism means. It's not the water. It's not the outward cleansing of the body, as 1 Peter 3 tells us. It's the cleansing of the soul. When you do what God says, God will then will reward you with forgiveness of sins, like He rewarded Naaman with leprosy, healing his leprosy. And then we have the other stories of Gehazi being cursed with the leprosy when he tells a lie and does what he does. The axe head, that's another one that's kind of strange. What's the purpose why he throws in some of these that are just kind of off the cuff, random type miracles? What's the point being made? Even though they don't make a whole lot of sense to us, when it said, I was cutting with this axe and the axe head fell off the handle and went into the water and I borrowed it, so I got to give it back and now I can't find it. I'm in trouble here. And he says, takes that little twig thing, throws it in the water, the axe head floats to the top, and he says, get your axe head. You're going, what does that have to do with anything? And what does it have to do with anything? Yes, sir.
You were mentioning the story of Naaman. Not coincidental that Naaman, when he dips in the Jordan, it's not coincidental that Jesus, when he comes up out of the water, he's coming up out of the water in the Jordan.
That's right.
When you read all of the Old Testament texts and these stories, they're really not just stories. They're actually pointing to Jesus Christ. There's deeper meanings, but you really have to search them out.
Yep.
And the Spirit of God actually has to lead that thing, and you really start to see that it was all pointing towards Jesus before Jesus would come. So that the Bible itself, you was mentioning miracles. The Holy Scriptures themselves is a miracle in and of itself in the way in which it's written.
Yep.
Because he's telling you the end from the beginning.
Yeah. And that's the point we're trying to make sure we all understand. We can sit here and go through all of these different stories and see all these things. It's just the idea that God is the God of miracles and they represent, the Old Testament points to the New Testament, doesn't it? And we start beginning to see the connection between what's going on in the Old and the fulfillment in the New. And that's what I think we need to understand is some of the miracles, even that Jesus worked, they seemingly were kind of insignificant. Just on the surface, but we see that the bigger picture, that God was behind it, and whatever God does is perfect. So again, looking at all the different ones that were here, I don't have time to go through each one of the miracles, but I do want you to get you to understand that in 2 Kings 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8, you have a lot of the miracles of Elisha over and over and over again. They're fascinating stories that you need to spend time with. We get over into chapter 9 and 10, though, and we get to the story of Jehu. Who is this guy and what does he do? Give me an overview real quickly. What does Jehu do? God's got something he's got to do with Ahab and Jezebel. And what is it that Jehu is called by God to do? Yep, clean him out. Clean out the bad period of time with Ahab and Jezebel when he went and married that woman, the Phoenician woman, and brings her over and she introduces Baal worship into the nation. And God says, I'm going to eradicate that. And I'm going to clean out the lineage of Ahab and Jezebel. And so Jehu is God's messenger to do that. He gets a little overboard. He goes too far in some cases. But what he does is he is called by God to destroy Ahab's line. And so he begins the process and you begin to see what he does. Does some pretty dastardly things, but God called him to do it. To kill the 70 sons, and then Ahaziah's 42 brothers are killed by Jehu as well. And the entire family line is killed, and the Baal worshipers are all killed. And then in chapters 11 and 12, we have the story of Athaliah and how she kills all the lineage except Joash, and then he is spared. Athaliah is then executed, and then the death of Joash. But I promised Andy I'd get through chapter 12, and I just did. So he can pick up with chapter 13 next week. That was our agreement. So I kept my word. We'll see if he keeps his. Thank you for your time.